Merely formal almsgiving has little value. Almsgiving has true meaning and substance, and contains within it the power of salvation when mercy is offered to the poor out of love. We also see that when the Lord was on earth, he watched the people putting money into the treasury for the temple. Many wealthy people were putting in large sums. Then, among all these people, a poor widow came and put in two small coins, 2 pennies, we might say today. The Lord, who knew the true circumstances of each person, said that the widow had put in more than the rich. She had given the smallest amount of money, but her disposition was excellent, and she gave all the wealth she possessed for the temple of God. The others gave out of their abundance, but she gave everything she had. This shows that it is not the amount, whether great or small, but the disposition behind the almsgiving that is praised and blessed. The Lord blessed those at his right hand, because out of love and for his sake they had shown mercy, offered help, and visited the sick and the imprisoned. He placed them at his right hand, which means that he granted them his kingdom. For this reason, our almsgiving must spring above all from love for the person in need. Almsgiving is not limited to material things. To giving something to a person in need, a greater and more powerful form of almsgiving, bearing abundant fruit, is to help someone who is in spiritual and emotional need. When someone is in despair, and we approach and comfort him, we may stop him from descending further into hopelessness, a descent that often leads a person even to suicide. When we show mercy to such a person with just a few words of love and tenderness, that act of mercy reaches to the very throne of God. He says, "He who brings forth what is precious from what is worthless shall be as my mouth." When we save someone in despair from his despair, and give him courage and strength to endure his trial, his need, his hardship, whatever is tormenting him, and deliver him from the downward path to destruction, this is a very great act of mercy indeed. Therefore, we must be discerning, or rather, whatever we offer our neighbor must come from our heart, and must not be merely a formality. We see that God repays almsgiving 100-fold. You give one, and God gives you 100. You give something, and God receives it as a loan, and is bound to repay you 100-fold. St. Gregory the Dialogist, who later became Pope of Rome, when Rome was Orthodox, was the abbot of a monastery. God wished to test the depth of his mercy and love. So he sent an angel in the guise of a shipwrecked man, who said that his ship had run aground. He came dressed in rags and looking extremely poor. The angel, appearing as a shipwrecked man, came to the monastery and asked for alms. The saint said to his deacon, "Give him 1 gold coin. Although it seemed improper for the man to return and ask again, the saint said, "Give him 1 more. The deacon replied, "Geronta, we have nothing else in the treasury." "What else do we have?" "We have a silver plate that your mother gave you," he said. "Give him that as well." So he gave him that too. Years passed. God counted him worthy to rise from being an abbot to becoming pope and a saintly man. One day, on his birthday, he wished to hold a meal and said to his deacon, "Gather 12 poor men, representing the 12 apostles, so that we may offer them hospitality." The deacon went out, brought back 12 poor men, and seated them at the table. The holy pope also sat down and ate with them. He counted them and found 13. 13, my eyes," he said, "are turning 12 into 13. He looked again and counted them once more. 13. The 13th man's face kept changing. One moment it looked one way, the next moment another. He realized that some mystery was hidden here. When the meal was over and the poor had left, he held the 13th man back. "You stay here. In the name of God, tell me what you are." "I am not a human being, holy master." "Then what are you?" "I am an angel of God." "I have come to tell you, holy pope, that because of your almsgiving, God counted you worthy to become pope. Do you remember the shipwrecked man who came years ago and asked you for money? You gave 2 gold coins to a poor man, and so the saint had been tested in the sight of God. How many times might the same thing have happened to us? The Lord may have tested us by sending us someone in need, some poor person asking for help, and we may have helped them, or we may not have. As the Apostle Paul says, many have unknowingly received angels as guests when God was testing them. A person, a Christian, sows the seed of almsgiving and thinks that what he gave has been lost. But almsgiving is never lost. It is like the farmer who sows seed. It is buried in the earth, and one might think it has decayed and disappeared. No. The seed decays, but afterward it sprouts and bears fruit. In the same way, almsgiving is sown today, and the time will come when God will repay it abundantly, not only in this world, but above all in the world to come. For whatever a person gives to the poor and those in need is deposited in God's treasury in heaven, and when his soul departs and goes there, it will draw upon the treasure laid up through his almsgiving. There was once an emperor in Byzantium who, through the influence of a demon, brought ruin upon a young woman, the only daughter of a devout widow. This devout mother appealed to the Most Holy Theotokos, praying that she would punish the emperor for the great evil he had done to her daughter. She pleaded again and again, "Punish him, my Most Holy Theotokos, for the evil he has done to me." She offered many paraklesis services, and one day the Most Holy Theotokos appeared to her and said, "I would bring suffering upon the emperor and punish him, but his right hand will not allow me." The emperor was merciful, and because he gave so generously in alms, his merciful right hand would not allow the Most Holy Theotokos to punish him. It held back God's punishment. Consider how great the power of this virtue is to help a person. But how can God's mercy toward mankind ever be measured or fathomed? Is it not by God's mercy that we are sustained? Do we not ask for mercy and forgiveness night and day? We will receive forgiveness and mercy when we ourselves sow mercy and forgiveness. Saint John the Merciful, Patriarch of Alexandria, was exceedingly merciful. He had established a home for the elderly and other charitable institutions, and he supported them with the alms given by the people. When the Christians saw the good work of the patriarch, they offered him great sums of money. One day a poor person came to him, and he said to his deacon, "Give this person 1,000 drachmas. But the deacon, who was in charge of the treasury, thought, "Why should I give so much? I will give only 500 drachmas. And without telling the patriarch, he gave the person 500. Then a check arrived from a certain woman for 50,000 drachmas. He said, "Deacon, this woman's check should have been for 100,000. Did you perhaps give less to the person who asked for alms?" He replied, "Yes, your beatitude, instead of 1,000, I gave 500. The patriarch said, "Look how much harm you have done, and how greatly you have deprived the poor and the elderly whom we care for here. And so that you may see the truth of the matter, we shall call the woman herself." They notified the woman, and she came. "Tell me, madam, how much money had you intended to send for the poor?" She replied, "Your beatitude, I had decided to send 100,000 drachmas. But as I was writing the check, I do not know how it happened. I wrote 50,000, and I thought that must be how much I needed to send." When the deacon saw what had happened, he corrected his ways, and from then on he did whatever the patriarch told him. Here we see God's hundredfold reward. This concerns material things, but almsgiving rises all the way to the throne of God. Almsgiving brings down God's mercy upon a person. Whoever shows mercy finds mercy. Whoever spreads love receives love. We should practice this virtue not only in material ways, but also spiritually. We should help anyone in need, whether materially or spiritually. There are so many people who are suffering, and they have such need of a comforting word. We all suffer especially from troubling thoughts, from logismoi intrusive thoughts, and from psychological problems. We all need the alms of a kind word, some comfort, someone drawing near to us, a compassionate look, and so forth. All these things help. They show mercy to the suffering, the afflicted, the unhappy, and the despairing. We must help in every way we can because, as we know, we do not know exactly when the Lord will call us to depart from here. Our life is passing, and we must take care to show mercy to our own soul through almsgiving. As we said at the beginning of this talk, at Christ's second coming, Christ will bless some and condemn others. He will bless those on his right, because they offered love and almsgiving. He will condemn those on his left, because they withheld these two great virtues from the poor. At the second coming, Christ will ask nothing else of those who are judged. He will ask whether they offered love and almsgiving. We do not need to possess much in order to give. Even the smallest thing, if we offer it with love, counts for a great deal before God. Therefore, with whatever strength we have, let us help and show mercy. If we have bodily strength, let us physically assist someone who is unable either to work or to care for himself. If we can help through our words, let us speak. Above all, we must take care to ask God to give us a spirit of love, because love means mercy. The person who loves knows how to show mercy. 2 years ago, in a city here in America, we had gathered downstairs in the church, and were speaking together. We had said quite a lot. The priest who was translating brought the talk to a close so that we could continue the next day. But among the people in the audience, I noticed one man who seemed somewhat restless. This man wanted something. I said to the priest, "Father, let us hear this man, because he has something he wants to say." The man stood up, and with great anguish, if not even indignation, said to me, "Father, you spoke about Christ, and you spoke about the Apostle Paul. Everything you said was good. But I suffer from weak faith and unbelief. I cannot believe in God. Who will give me faith in God and relieve me from the torment I feel within because I do not believe? Who will prove to me that God exists? Who will deliver me from this hell that I have within me? How many men and women must be suffering as I do? Who will help all these people? Look, I myself am suffering," he said. "I have no one to deliver me from this state. Within myself, I feel hell." I said to the priest, "Let us wait a little longer. Please sit down, people of God." I spoke to him about the existence of God, and then I dwelt on a historical account. "The story is this," I told him. "Napoleon, the Emperor of France, was a wise man and a master of the art of warfare. He knew how to devise strategies to outmaneuver his enemy. This Napoleon was a devout and believing man. He had an unbelieving general who did not believe in God. The emperor knew this, and often tried to persuade him and bring him to faith, but the general resisted and would not believe. Now, out of love and a desire to save him, the emperor said to him one day, 'My general, I invite you to dine with me tomorrow at noon.' 'Me, your majesty?' 'Yes, you. I want to give a dinner in your honor. Will you not accept?' 'It is an honor,' he replied, 'but I am not worthy. No, I myself am granting you this honor. You must come.' The next day, before the general arrived, the emperor brought a globe and placed it in the middle of the table. When the general arrived and sat down, the emperor said, 'The first thing I must tell you, my general, is that this globe you see here sprang into existence all by itself.' The general looked at him rather strangely and said, 'Your majesty, you must be joking.' 'No, I am not joking at all. I firmly believe that this classroom globe made itself. I do not know how it happened, but somehow it just appeared here on the table.' 'That is impossible,' the general said. 'I believe it is possible, but your majesty, you must take me for a madman.' 'Yes, indeed, you are a madman,' the emperor then told him. 'If you firmly believe that this insignificant globe was made by a craftsman, a scientist, or someone capable of giving it this shape, then how can you refuse to believe in the universe? It has functioned in a mysterious and exquisitely ordered way, with precision down to the smallest measure, for millions upon millions of years, without deviating in the least, for the slightest deviation of the heavenly bodies would bring about the destruction of the universe.' As soon as the general heard this, he raised his hands and said, 'I surrender. I believe in the existence of God.' I told that story for the occasion, and the people who heard it liked it very much and applauded. It strengthened and inspired them, because they saw it as a very tangible testimony to the existence of God. This Christian was greatly comforted. He felt relieved and became calm. I told him, 'My good man, come to the church tomorrow morning. You will have the opportunity to make your holy confession. I will tell you more to strengthen your faith, and God willing, we will bring this matter to a good conclusion.' The man came, made his holy confession, and I spoke to him at length about God. I also told him that I would send him a suitable book to strengthen him. He followed this advice and began to put his life in some order. But it was a devout woman who had brought this man to us. Out of love for him, she did so because he had no one and nothing in this world. He had been living there alone in a foreign land for years, without a single relative. This woman felt compassion for him, in the good sense of Christian love, and wanted to help him. Perhaps they had spoken before, and she had seen that no one cared for him. She thought, this man needs to draw near to the church, and so she brought him. This summer, I received a phone call from that woman. She called me. She said to me, Father Ephraim, is that you? Yes, it is. Do you remember me? Of course. And Costas? Most certainly. How is Costas? I asked her. Costas has died. What? Listen, Father, I have been trying for 2 weeks to reach you by telephone, to tell you that Costas died and to ask you to serve 40 divine liturgies for him. Listen to what happened. Do you remember this man? The one who came to confession? Of course, my dear, I said to her. He left for Greece, fell ill while he was there, and then returned here to America. In the meantime, I had lost touch with him. One day, a thought came to me to call and see whether he had returned, and when I called, I found him at home. How are things, Costas? How are you? And so on. I'm ill, brother. Come here, he told him. Come, and we'll help you. The man got up and came to our home. I told him, Costas, we are going to the priest so that you can make your holy confession and receive Holy Communion. Feeling obliged, he said, let us go. The dear woman immediately telephoned our priest. They took Costas to the church, where he confessed all the sins he had committed and received the holy mysteries. She then told him, now that you are ill, we are also going to the hospital. There is no need. No, we will go to the hospital and find out what is wrong with you. This dear woman took him there, and the examinations showed that his body was full of cancerous tumors. They took him into surgery and opened him up. What did the doctor find? Not one tumor, nor merely two, but cancer everywhere. He closed the incision and had Costas taken to a hospital room. The woman said to him, Costas, will you receive Holy Communion again? Yes, sister, let me receive. At once this dear woman went and brought their priest with Holy Communion. When the priest arrived, the woman was there with her husband. My Costas, she said, open your eyes so that you may receive Holy Communion. But he had already fallen into the throes of death. The woman kept calling out, Costas, open your eyes. I have brought the priest and Holy Communion, please. I tried to rouse him this way and that, but there was no response. I fell to my knees, Father, she said, and began to weep and lament, pleading, my God, open this man's eyes and mouth, so that he may receive your holy body and precious blood. Have mercy, my God. This woman had such great love. And finally, in a strange and miraculous way, the man opened his eyes and his mouth and received the holy mysteries. After receiving, he closed his mouth and eyes again and fell back into unconsciousness. We rejoiced, he says, because he had received Holy Communion and would depart this life with Holy Communion. Then, this dead man suddenly opened his eyes and mouth once more, sat upright in bed, raised his hands, and began to glorify and praise God with all his heart for the mercy he had shown him. He had received the holy gifts and experienced many things because, it seems, he deeply felt the grace of God through Holy Communion. And after he had praised God so fervently, Father, he lay back down by himself upon the pillow, closed his eyes and mouth, and with three breaths surrendered his soul to God. Think of this man, unconfessed, far from God, and without faith. That woman brought him there. God granted that he should believe, make his confession, receive Holy Communion, and depart for the other world with the great hope of salvation. This kind of almsgiving knows no bounds. See what one person can offer another. When she told me all this over the telephone, I was so deeply moved that I said to her, My child, what can I say to you? I give you so many blessings that I cannot even express them. I did nothing, Father, she replied. I said, God knows, and I know too what you did. Therefore, whenever we make an effort, when, for example, we know someone who does not go to holy confession and is far from God, and we approach him and say a few words, then even if he does not return to God or reach holy confession, the very fact that we went to him, spoke to him, told him a few things about God, and offered him a little counsel to change his life is itself an act of almsgiving. He did not go. If we spoke an evil word, we would believe that it was a sin. When we lead someone into evil with five words or one piece of bad advice, we feel guilty and say that we have sinned. Conversely, when we speak five words about God and offer one piece of good advice, we should believe that this is an excellent act of almsgiving toward our neighbor. One spiritual father has a very good custom. Someone would come to him for holy confession, and let us suppose that person was a blasphemer. Those 10 will become 100, and so on. For this reason, all of us must strive to show mercy to others, especially to those who are far from God. Everyone has a neighbor close at hand. A woman may have another woman living beside her, a neighbor who, well, you can see it, does not draw near to the church, does not read anything spiritual, and so forth. We see the Jehovah's Witnesses standing outside on street corners, deceiving people and leading them away from Christ to the devil. And we say that they are doing immense harm. In this respect, they are almost antichrists. Consider then, what a great thing it is when we Christians do the opposite and bring people to Christ. The whole world is not equal in worth to a single soul. 10,000 worlds cannot compare with the value and salvation of one soul. Therefore, whoever saves another person will cover a multitude of sins. Many of his own sins will be blotted out when he helps save someone. So, as part of our work of almsgiving, let us strive to help and show mercy also to those who are poor in soul and impoverished in their spiritual life. And the reward before God will be very great. Just think of the salvation of this man, this unbeliever, and so on. He goes to confession. He had been far from God for so many years abroad, with all that he had done and all that he had made of his life, and in the end, in a single moment, he is saved. God blotted out everything he had done. And that dear soul who helped him won crowns for herself. In her humility she may say, I have done nothing. But when her soul departs this life, the soul of that man will stand before her. That person who was saved will, among other things, pray especially for the soul who helped him and who is now in the glory of God. I was lost, he will think. And if that person had not crossed my path, I would be in hell now. But he is now in the glory of God, and within himself he feels boundless gratitude. He also makes every effort, praying for that soul, asking God to help her in her troubles and in everything else, and after her death she will find him there before her as a helper. Just think, here we are speaking of one soul, but when many souls have been helped by us, imagine what great help we shall have at that hour, when our own soul departs. Conversely, I also see the responsibility we bear. Sin is not only committed when we do something sinful, yet we have never confessed the sin of failing to help when we were able to help. In other words, failing to do good to our neighbor is a sin, and we have not confessed it as such. How many times through negligence, spiritual sloth, laziness, or lack of love have we failed to offer our help to someone? We do not recognize this as sin. We think we sin only when we do something evil. But is this not also evil? How many times have we seen someone suffering and failed to approach them? And we say, what is it to us? Let them sort it out on their own. No, that is not Christian. Therefore, we must take up a new spiritual struggle to help our neighbor as much as we can. We may go to a hospital and see someone there. We can give them a little book, sit beside them and say a few words. Have patient endurance. Be long-suffering. This is a cross. The love of God is near you. God is calling you now and preparing you to hear the word of God. For when a person is prosperous, for the most part he is cold toward the things of God, toward his salvation, and toward his neighbor. He lacks compassion. The word of God does not affect him. But when he is laid upon a bed and pain begins to plow and prepare his heart and soul to receive the word, then God begins to intervene miraculously. Pain transforms the human soul. It softens both soul and heart, making them receptive to hearing the word of God. A person may return to Christ through a trial, whether through illness, tribulation, or many other things. Let me give one example among many. I was in Thessaloniki when I learned that there had been a traffic accident, a very minor one, of course. Some of my spiritual children had gone off the road and were being taken to the hospital. So I turned back toward Thessaloniki and went to the hospital. I found the dear women there in their beds. I blessed them with the cross, counseled them, and comforted them. Then a man approached me, although other priests had already passed through there. He was a young married man, and he said, Father, can you hear my confession? Of course I can. Let us go. We went into the ward, and I heard his full confession. But this man had never confessed before. In his all-wise providence, God made him ill and brought him to the hospital. He arranged for us to meet there, illumined him, and gave him the confidence to think, I can confess to this man. And so holy confession took place. The man changed and set out upon the path of return. Thus, through the trial of illness that brought him to the hospital, God healed him spiritually. Therefore, with God's illumination, we Christians can offer a great deal. We can give abundant alms to our neighbor, especially, as we have said, spiritual almsgiving, which has immense value. And they gave up their place to this man who had come for the first time. Is that not almsgiving? A man comes, especially someone who has no time to wait and has never confessed before, and a woman gives him her place. The man confesses, is saved, and makes a new beginning in his life. Such almsgiving is beyond measure. Its value cannot be calculated. This salvation came about through that woman's offering. And yet that soul may not have received it. So what? Even so, this deed is exceedingly great. This, then, is how we must labor and help the souls of our neighbors. And God, who was crucified for this soul that is being saved, will grant a crown of glory and salvation to the person who helped it. And let us thank our Christ from the depths of our souls for counting us worthy to be Orthodox Christians and to have this grace and this opportunity to help others so that we may dwell eternally with him in the glory of God. Something partial. He gave him one gold coin. The man left, but returned a few days later and said to the abbot, Saint Gregory, I lost a great deal, and you gave me very little. You must give me more. Deacon, give him another gold coin. So he gave it to him. The man returned yet again and said, Give me more, for I lost a great deal. He was testing him. But the saint did not lose his patient endurance by driving him away or rebuking him harshly. Yes, I was that poor man. God sent me to test you. And because of that act of almsgiving, he counted you worthy to become pope. From now on, I will stand invisibly beside you, and whatever you want and whatever you desire, I will bring before Christ and return to you with his answer. You see what a great thing the saint accomplished here by giving to God. And you see, at the final moment, God's providence arranged for this woman, through her love and almsgiving, to give of herself, to bring him to the sermon, to help him in every way she could, to strive to take him to church, to receive Holy Communion, and to take him to the hospital. Nothing can repay such love. Even if she had given a fortune, it could not compare with this great act of mercy she showed to that man. Since you are a blasphemer, he would tell him, bring me 10 other blasphemers to confess, and I will forgive you. You may receive Holy Communion as early as tomorrow. So the man would make every effort to persuade 10 people to come, and the priest would say, there, receive Holy Communion today. And look at the spiritual gain. The man came, and through this wise method, the priest told him, this will be your canon, your rule of prayer, nothing else. Bring 10 people to holy confession. And so he tried to bring 10 people. Our soul. The pain of God. Before this, when he was healthy, if anyone spoke to him about salvation, about God, and so on, he was indifferent. But once suffering has done all this preparatory work, and a man of God approaches him and says a few words to him, and opens a little book, the gospel, he immediately changes and begins to reflect. The words of God take effect, and he begins to consider his salvation, his transformation, and his return to God. How many millions of people owe their return to him to this? What great value this has! We must all undertake a new crusade of mercy toward our neighbor, not so much in material terms, but from a spiritual perspective. We should strive to help our neighbor, as they do at Ripon. We now have holy confession every day. People come for the first time, and I have seen many souls give up their own number and place in line.